council, if you'd like to pour yourself a glass of water, you sure have time to do that.
I'll drink afterwards.
Okay. No, that's.
I'm a little cold, and I thought I'd be rid of it by now, but.
Please, sir, don't apologize. We're sorry you're ill.
Thank you. May it please the court. Alan Epstein, representing Alex Jones. May it please counsel. The issue defendant raises on appeal concerns a comment made by plaintiff's counsel during closing argument. That comment was, and let me stop right here and say this, any suggestion that Mr. Jones is personally paying this is wrong. Defendant's counsel objected to this comment, to which the court responded, I'm not going to allow you to go there. Under Rule of Evidence 411, evidence of a party's liability insurance is improper. Inadvertent or incidental mention of insurance is not necessarily grounds for reversal. But where counsel's closing argument remarks inform the jury that a judgment will be paid by the defendant's insurance carrier, a new trial may be warranted, and defendant submits that a new trial is warranted here. Plaintiff argues that defendant is not entitled to a new trial because defendant did not request a curative instruction. Defendant admittedly did not seek a curative instruction. Under certain circumstances, however, as the District of Columbia Appellate Court acknowledged in Scott v. Crestar Financial Corporation, a curative instruction may not unring a bell and may in fact exacerbate the problem. And defendant is relying on several cases in which neither a curative instruction nor a mistrial were requested, notwithstanding the appellate court reversed and remanded for a new trial when similar comments were made. Defendant submits this case is analogous to Carlson v. Healy, an Illinois Court of Appeals decision in which the plaintiff's counsel, in closing argument, commented several times about an insurance claim that had been admitted into evidence, implying to the jury that the defendant had liability insurance.
Mr. Epstein, pardon me for interrupting you, if I may. I'd like to ask a couple of questions about the comment itself before we proceed, if that's okay. The comment didn't use the word insurance, did it?
The comment didn't use the word insurance.
But that's right. I understand that it's your position, and I, of course, I respect this. I understand it's your position that it was implied, but the word insurance was not in the comment. And plus, there was only, during closing argument, there was only one reference, the one to which you've referred, right?
In closing argument, there was only the one reference made. However, during voir dire, one of the jury panel members inquired whether the judgment was going to be paid. If a judgment for $1.2 million, which was what plaintiff was requesting, was going to be rendered, was it going to be paid by the defendant personally or by the insurance company? And in conjunction with that inquiry,
But as I recall, no answer was given to that juror's question. Is that correct?
No, there was no inappropriate response given to that.
Okay.
But the jury was obviously sensitized to the issue when it asked that question.
But in comparison to the cases that you cite from out of state, there we don't have repeated references to insurance. We don't have specific references to insurance. And considering that the negligent driver in this case was a juvenile, there's some ambiguity in the statement because it's certainly possible that someone might think, well, because this driver was a juvenile, his or her parents would be responsible for paying. So I want you to tell me why you think this case is as serious as the ones you refer to from out of state.
Well, in the cases from out of state that I'm referring to, I don't know that the conclusion turned on the number of statements that were made. In fact, in one, I think there was only one comment made, and in one of them, there was reference to claims, not to insurance. So I don't believe that it is required that the term insurance be. That word be used. I think it is clear enough that statement, particularly when it came on the heels of defendant's counsel's argument, which I don't believe signaled that defendant did not have insurance, but that was how it was being interpreted. I think that the message was clear that what plaintiff's counsel was saying was, Mr. Jones is not personally paying this. The necessary inference is insurance is. That's how I read it.
Ken, thank you.
Couldn't there be another inference that's possible, Mr. Epstein, such as counsel, your opponent has suggested it could be that his family would be paying for it or someone else would be paying for it? Isn't that just as reasonable an interpretation as that it's an insurer?
In light of the fact that the jury inquired whether insurance would be paying it and that there was no suggestion or evidence that the defendant's parents would be paying it, and they weren't, as far as I know, they weren't in the courtroom, I don't know why that would be an inference. I didn't think of it until it was mentioned in the answer brief.
Even though there's not a specific rule of evidence, would it be proper to argue that the parents are paying for it? I mean, they're not insurance, but would that have even been a proper inference to draw?
I don't think it would. I think that would be no more proper than implying that insurance would pay for it, because the impact is that the jury's thinking, oh, well, he doesn't have to pay for it, somebody else is going to pay for it.
What about the other suggested ambiguity, that wrong didn't mean incorrect, but it meant procedurally wrong to go into that area?
Well, but the context of the statement doesn't imply a procedural impropriety. It implies that the implication that Mr. Jones is paying this is wrong. I don't perceive that it could be interpreted as a procedural impropriety. In the Carlson v. Healy case, an Illinois Court of Appeals decision, in which the plaintiff's counsel in closing argument commented about an insurance claim form that had been admitted into evidence, implying to the jury that the defendant had liability insurance. The trial court sustained the defendant's objection and instructed the jury that whether a party has insurance has no bearing whatever on any issue that you must decide. You must refrain from any inference, speculation, or discussion about insurance. Even though the defendant's objection was sustained and the jury admonished, the Illinois Court of Appeals held that the injection of insurance into the case was prejudicial enough to warrant a new trial. And in Pepe v. Klo, the Florida Court of Appeals held that the defendant was entitled to a new trial, where the plaintiff's counsel in closing argument stated, defendant's counsel just stood up here and told you that these folks have an interest in this case. These folks have insurance, and that is what will pay the judgment, the insurance company. The court held that the defendant was entitled to a new trial, even though the defendant's objection was sustained and plaintiff's counsel admonished. And although the word insurance was mentioned in closing argument, I think that what was stated in this case is analogous to that statement in Pepe.
I have a quick question about the standard of review. I know you're asserting that it's de novo, but aren't matters and argument generally an abuse of discretion standard of review?
Well, rulings on counsel's argument are reviewed. In my reply brief, I conceded that that type of ruling is reviewed under an abuse of discretion standard. In this case, there was no discretionary decision made. Though we are, because an objection was made, the remark was in response was made by the trial court. So there isn't. We are asking that the Court of Appeals determine that the statement in closing argument was prejudicial enough to warrant a new trial. We're not asking the trial to this court to review a denied mistrial motion, because I frankly am. Motion for mistrial wasn't made. Plaintiff relies on several Colorado cases that I believe are distinguishable. First, Johns v. Chanel. In Johns, the Supreme Court held that the trial court did not abuse its discretion in refusing to order a new trial when one of the plaintiff's witnesses inadvertently mentioned an insurance agent. That is not what happened here. Miller v. Rotec is also distinguishable. In Miller, this court rejected the defendant's argument that the plaintiff referring to a person on a videotape as an insurance adjuster compelled a new trial. The court reasoned that the comment was incidental and was made by the plaintiff, not plaintiff's counsel. That's also not what happened here. Jacobs v. Commonwealth Highland Theaters stands for the proposition that the inadvertent mention of insurance does not necessarily compel a new trial. In Jacobs, the reference was to claims forms, which the court reasoned was susceptible to an innocuous meaning. That is not what happened here, and the statement in this case was not inadvertent. It was made in response to something plaintiff's counsel heard defense counsel say in her closing argument. Plaintiff's argument that counsel's remark was susceptible to a neutral interpretation, I believe, is incorrect. I don't think there's any other meaning that could be attributed to the statement that any suggestion Mr. Jones is personally paying this is wrong in context could be interpreted as anything other than that insurance was paying this. Plaintiff argues that defendant's counsel opened the door to plaintiff's counsel's comment. The statements by defendant's counsel to which plaintiff refers were made in the context of argument regarding those damages for which defendant should be held responsible, as opposed to the amount of damages plaintiff was requesting for which he should not be responsible. Defendant was the party legally responsible for any damages verdict that the jury rendered. Defendant's counsel was not suggesting that defendant would personally pay any judgment. She was arguing that the damages claimed by plaintiff were excessive. Defendant's counsel did not say what was held to be inappropriate, for example, in the Cook investment case in which the statement in closing argument was made that anything defendant has to pay, it's coming out of his pocket. In any event, plaintiff's counsel did not object to defendant's counsel's remarks when they were made. If plaintiff's counsel perceived defendant's counsel's comments as implying that defendant did not have insurance, the remedy would have been to object and seek the court's intervention at that juncture, not to employ self-help by telling the jury that defendant was insured. And the trial court disagreed that defendant's counsel opened the door when the court stated that it would not allow plaintiff's counsel to go there. No authority supports plaintiff's argument that she was entitled to walk through an allegedly open door without first requesting that the trial court allow him to do so. Finally, plaintiff argues that if error, defendant has not demonstrated that plaintiff's counsel's comments prejudiced defendant. However, there is no means of demonstrating that evidence or that the argument was prejudicial without delving into the jury's thought process and reaching its verdict, which cannot be accomplished without violating Rule of Evidence 606B. Defendant submits he was prejudiced because the jury rendered a $750,000 judgment for an ulnar nerve injury. Thank you.
Mr. Epstein, doesn't your argument cut both ways if we cannot look to what the jury thought or didn't think? How can you say you were prejudiced by the size of the verdict as a result of this comment? I mean, if you're saying we can't look into what they thought and what they decided and the basis for their decision, which is so, for the plaintiff's argument, why doesn't that apply to your argument that you just made?
I think there's a presumption, just as if there was if it was an improper statement, then I would analogize to inadmissible evidence. There's no way of knowing whether inadmissible evidence influenced a jury because you can't delve into the thought process. The presumption is that the Court of Appeals indulges in is if it was inadmissible, we must assume it was prejudicial, even though we don't have an affidavit from a juror telling us that.
But we can look at whether it's harmless, can't we?
I don't think it can be deemed harmless because we don't know what influence it had. Thank you.
May it please the court, I'm Walter Sargent. I represent the plaintiff, Jeannie DeWeese. Defendant is seeking a new trial based on a single comment by plaintiff's counsel in closing argument. I have several points to make, but I want to start with the threshold issues of the standard of review and the preservation of error. In his opening brief, and again in his reply brief, defendant says the standard of review is de novo. In his reply brief, defendant even asserts, it says, defendant agrees with plaintiff that the standard of review is de novo. I assume based on what was just said that may have been a typographical error. It's not true, and defendant has cited nothing that would indicate a standard of review of de novo. Numerous cases have held that it's fully within the discretion of the trial court, reviewable only for abuse of discretion, whether a statement in closing argument is improper, and if so, how to best remedy it. Here, defendant hasn't identified anything that the trial court did to abuse its discretion. Defendant doesn't even say that the trial court did anything wrong. Defendant simply wants this court to order a new trial to remedy an allegedly improper comment by plaintiff's counsel. But the trial court, in the trial court, the defendant never requested a curative instruction, never requested a mistrial, no other remedy. And when the objecting party fails to request a remedy from the trial court, he may not assert for the first time on appeal that an allegedly improper statement of counsel during closing argument entitles him to a new trial. We've cited a number of cases, People v. Ignite, Celebrities Bowling versus Shattuck, People versus McNeely. Now, in his reply brief, and again in oral argument, defendant says curative instruction may have only emphasized the issue of insurance, so the failure to request curative instruction shouldn't prevent him from seeking a new trial. Well, first of all, curative instruction didn't have to say anything about insurance. The word insurance was never even mentioned. The trial court could have simply told the jury there's been no evidence about who, if anyone, is going to be paying any judgment. Counsel's statements do not constitute evidence. Even if there were such evidence, you would not be allowed to consider it because it's legally irrelevant to your job of determining damages. And I don't see why that wouldn't be perfectly adequate. But defendant didn't do that. If defendant didn't think that a curative instruction would be sufficient, then defendant could have moved for a mistrial. But you can't just keep silent, wait until you see the jury's verdict, and then go to the appellate court and say that you want a reversal of the trial court's judgment in a new trial. So the issue isn't preserved for review. Even if the defendant had preserved the issue for review, wouldn't be entitled to a new trial. Defendant says, where counsel's closing argument remarks clearly impart to the jury that a judgment will be paid by the defendant's insurance carrier, the defendant is entitled to a new trial. That misstates both the governing law and the facts in this case. For over 70 years, Colorado has flatly rejected the rule that when information about defendant's insurance, liability insurance, is improperly conveyed to the jury, incurable prejudice is assumed. Instead, the court in Johns v. Chenal said that it's treated like any other inadmissible testimony. Upon motion, it may be stricken and the jury instructed to disregard it. The trial court may, in its discretion, grant a motion for mistrial if it's convinced that there's an improper design to influence the jury and there's prejudice. But as this court in Cook versus 7-Eleven said, that only when the mention of insurance occurs in a flagrant manner that clearly prejudices the rights of a defendant is the trial court's denial of a motion for mistrial reversible error. Well, here, of course, there was not even a motion for mistrial. There wasn't even a mention of insurance. Plaintiff counsel merely said any suggestion that Mr. Jones is personally paying this is wrong. What does that mean? Well, I suppose that it could mean that Alex Jones, the 16-year-old driver in this case, isn't going to personally pay a big judgment for whatever reason.
To the extent that you're arguing that the parents, that the jury could have construed the argument as that the parents might be paying, would that have been a proper argument or a proper inference?
I guess my view is that it should be legally irrelevant. So I think it's an alternative to the suggestion that it was insurance. But I think in either case, it's not something that should be brought up. But of course, it could also mean, as we discussed, that it was simply wrong. It was simply improper for defense counsel to suggest that this large sum of money would be coming out of this young man's pocket, regardless of whether that was true or not. Defense counsel had said that her client, that was the term she used, Alex Jones, the 16-year-old, would be penalized by an excessive award, and that her client, she again used that term, Alex Jones, should pay the damages he caused, that it was his responsibility to pay those damages, and he was not running away from that responsibility. Well, those statements certainly seem to suggest that the lawyer's client personally would be penalized by this big judgment.
Mr. Sargent, how's a defense lawyer supposed to phrase that to the jury, in your view? What would be your preferred phrasing?
Simply discuss what damages have been caused and what appropriate damages are to be awarded and assessed, but not talk in terms of a penalty being assessed against her client by virtue of a large judgment. And she shouldn't have been saying that he's assumed that his responsibility is to pay this when she knows that he's not going to pay it. And those are just...
Actually, we don't know that. That's outside the record. It's possible this is a rich kid. We don't know.
That's right.
That's true, Your Honor. And as I said, I mean, whether they were true or not, they weren't statements that should have been said. There should be no suggestion here by either side about who is paying for this. And in fact, in the record at page 553, plaintiff's attorney actually said, told the jurors in opening statements, the only thing you can consider is the amount of harm she has sustained. No other thing, no other outside reasons. He said, we talked a little bit in jury selection. No sympathy. You can't decide to compensate Jeannie with more money because you're sympathetic to her. That's not right. That's not fair. That's an outside reason. Sympathy from Mr. Jones, same thing. You can't deduct money because of sympathy or any outside reason. So plaintiff's attorney was very consistent about this. So let's not look at who's paying for this. And again, when the defense objected, the plaintiff's attorney responded to the objection saying, she, defense counsel, brought it up in closing argument, and she knows that's wrong. That's improper. And it's also what plaintiff's counsel said during voir dire when the prospective juror asked, well, who's going to pay for this? He says, I'm not allowed to answer that question. And neither was defense counsel, especially when defense counsel was making a suggestion that, well, let's say we believe to be untrue. And that brings me to my next point. In Cook versus 7-Eleven, this court held that it is improper for defense counsel during closing argument to mislead the jury into believing that an insured defendant lacks insurance or would suffer financially as a result of an adverse judgment. And in fact, in Tomeo versus Northern Valley Swim Club, the New Jersey appellate court described it as a reprehensible tactic by defense counsel in closing argument to make such a suggestion. And in Canopy versus Peterson, this court, citing Tomeo, recognized that a misleading suggestion could open the door to telling the jury that the party is actually insured. Now, in his reply brief and again today, defendant suggests that if plaintiff had a problem with what defense counsel said, then he should have stood up and objected immediately instead of waiting for rebuttal. But and that may be true if we were the appellants arguing for reversal based on inappropriate statements by defense counsel. But in terms of prejudice to the defendant, which is what we're looking at here, what's the difference between an objection by plaintiff's counsel standing up and saying, Your Honor, it is wrong for counsel to say this and saying it in rebuttal. I don't think there is.
Well, let's take your argument another step, Mr. Sargent. What, for example, you know, this appears to be some sort of fair comment argument on your part. What if counsel, instead of said there's something wrong, said there's insurance in this case. There's insurance in this case, and the insurance is going to be paying. Something that direct. Are you telling me you'd still be saying that the appropriate remedy would be to make that sort of responsive argument as opposed to object at the time? If the argument is wrong, it's wrong, right?
I'm not sure I understood that. Are you saying if the plaintiff's counsel had said there's insurance?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. If the plaintiff's counsel, instead of saying it's wrong, mm-hmm. said there's insurance.
Okay.
I mean, I guess what I'm saying, that would be a wrong argument, right? Legally wrong.
Counsel
yes.
I think at that point, defense counsel might say, Your Honor, you shouldn't have said that.
We had big problems at that point because it was wrong.
Right, Your Honor.
And I guess what I'm trying to address is your tit for tat argument.
Right.
And I'm concerned about that because I don't know how far that goes.
Right.
I have some sympathy for Mr. Epstein's argument that if you've got a problem, object at the time rather than playing tit for tat.
Right. I understand that, Your Honor. And but of course, again, I mean, whether it's appropriate to play tit for tat or perhaps it should have been objected to immediately. But in any event, there's no prejudice, and it would be the same prejudice in either case. And that gets me to my last point that there is no prejudice. First, the comment by plaintiff's counsel was neither flagrant. Nor false, nor repeated, and this court in Cook versus 7-Eleven went through that analysis and those factors. Second, the jury was, in fact, specifically instructed about what it could consider in awarding damages. It was specifically instructed that it couldn't consider counsel's statements as evidence. It was, and that only evidence that was admitted at trial could be considered. The jury is presumed to follow those instructions, and we've cited a number of cases in similar contexts involving allegedly improper statements by closing counsel where the court has gone through that analysis. And third, the total damages in this case were not excessive. They were a little over midway between what defendant was conceding, what plaintiff was seeking. There was a tremendous amount over several days of testimony, medical testimony, lay testimony. Defendant now, frankly, belittles plaintiff's injury, says the jury awarded $750 for an injured ulnar nerve. Well, the injuries included fractures in the upper and lower extremities, back and neck injuries, permanent damage to the ulnar nerve in the left hand, the left arm, permanent disability, chronic, probably permanent damage or pain, narcotic drug dependency, very limited employment prospects for the remainder of her life. There's plenty of evidence to support the damages. So just to summarize, defendant failed to preserve the argument, failed to show or even allege any trial court error, failed to show that the comment was improper, failed to show prejudice. The judgment should be affirmed. And I'm open to any more questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Sargent. I thought you had about 12 seconds, Mr. Epstein, but okay. Gentlemen, thank you very much for your argument today. We appreciate them. The case will stand submitted, and an opinion will issue in due course. This brings to a close our oral arguments today for Division 7. Therefore, we shall be in recess, and if the bailiff would please announce it.
What I want to know is...